Welcome to the podcast, Disrupt Education. You're at it. Hit that subscribe button. I would love that. I'm your host, Peter Hostrasser. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. If you get a chance, head over to disrupteducation.co and check out all the podcasts and blogs, different places I'm going to be. We can connect there as well. On this podcast, I've got a great guest, Komal Shah. She leverages her passion for education, business expertise, and personal conscious living practices to shift outdated educational paradigms and transforms the educational systems for the betterment of children. She shares her journey from being a teacher to being an educational consultant, thought leader, and the author of the upcoming book, Bringing Consciousness to Education. I've got Komal coming up right after these messages. Hang on. I recently asked Jake, who is a sophomore in high school, why he uses SpikeView to share his learning journey.
I think it's really cool that, you know, SpikeView is really putting that abstract into concrete data and knowledge and then displaying that to the outside world. And I think SpikeView is different than anything else out there. Like I said before, because it's really taking that, you know, those abstract skill sets and those abstract experiences and putting them into data that, you know, is actually mathematic and scientific and, you know, that matches you up with the best programs and, you know, best places for you. People, you know, who are really trying to make those changes in the world, and they're going to be using SpikeView because SpikeView is that app where you can, you know, take those experiences and take those passions and put them out there. And share with other people. And that's, you know, that's really powerful. And that, you know, that professional networking piece, you know, to be with other like-minded teenagers, that puts you ahead. That puts you ahead in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I think anyone who uses SpikeView right now has a leg up in the future, and excited to see, you know, where those SpikeView alumni head up.
Head to SpikeView.com. Start your portfolio now for free. Have you ever thought about creating courses and training online? Without a partner to guide you through that process, you're going to be stressed about why your learners aren't engaged or how to create updated content, missing revenue opportunities, and not even having enough time. I know because I create online courses, and I have a solution for you, e-learning partners. You don't have to be overwhelmed anymore. Become a partner with eLearning Partners to create your courses and training stress-free and achieve the results you want to see. If you are thinking about wanting to create a course or training online and you believe like I believe that no expertise should go unheard, then click the eLearning Partners link in the notes of this podcast and you can start your journey to create your courses and training stress-free. If you want all that and more from the eLearning Partners, hit the link in the podcast notes because there's a free masterclass for you to take. That's right, a free masterclass. Hit that link today. The Disrupt Education vlog can be found on YouTube. To hear it in podcast form, search Disrupt Education on any of the following podcast platforms: Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Breaker, Castbox, Overcast, Radio Public, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or Stitcher. Welcome to this episode of Disrupt Education. I'm Peter Hostrasser, the host. Hey, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate if you hit that subscribe button. You'll never miss an episode. And give us some feedback. We love that too. I have a wonderful guest today. Komal Shah is with me and just an amazing human being around the humanistic approach, but wasn't always going to be in education. So, Komal, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Awesome, awesome. And connected with a great group of people on LinkedIn, but let's start with who you are. Let's talk a little bit about that. So if you want to tell listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in San Diego in a pretty tight-knit Indian American community. And I always tell people that I was a really good student growing up, whatever that means. So, you know, I think education was just really emphasized in my family and at home. So it was all about getting good grades, listening to teachers, the whole shebang. And, you know, college was kind of that end goal. So I ended up going to college, being a bio major, you know, trying to be a doctor, surprise, surprise. And, you know, it's funny because by the end of my senior year of undergrad, I think is when I really started questioning, I think, a little bit about, like, do I want to be a doctor? Like, first of all, I'm scared of blood, so this is probably not going to work out so well for me in the first place. But, you know, and kind of had a couple of situations that led me to apply to Teach for America. And funny enough, it was a program I'd never heard of before. But as if the people don't know or the listeners don't know, it's a two-year program where you are going to work in an underserved community. And so I applied, got in, don't know how, and ended up in Northern California, where I taught sixth and seventh grade math for 5 years. And I'll always say, you know, I never looked back. I think the minute I stepped into a classroom, I was like, this is it. Education is my life. These students are my life. And it's kind of led me down this path right now.
That's amazing. I love that story because there's such a pivot in there. And, you know, we've had previous conversations about past of educators and being in education in general out in California. Did you spend all your time in California with all your kind of primary and secondary education? And tell us a little bit about that path in general, and how is it different with the schools that you're working, that you worked with as in Teach for America?
Yeah. Wow. Stark difference, to say the least. I think for my family, we were privileged enough to kind of work, live in suburbia, where most of the schools surrounding us were blue ribbon schools. And actually, one of the reasons my dad wanted to come to California is because he knew that the universities that were here and the opportunities for in-state tuition and, you know, so forth were so vast. So that's kind of what led us here in the first place. But growing up, when I say blue ribbon schools, you're looking at students who, you know, come from good backgrounds, whatever. When I say good, I mean they have resources, right? And so it was kind of the situation where everyone kind of had the common goal of going to college, and you do well in school and you get good grades and you take as many AP classes as you can so you can boost that GPA. And so I think most of my education kind of looked like that. Now, it also looked like me just sitting in a desk listening to a teacher in the front. And I point that out because obviously that has changed for me of what a good education is. But at the time, that's all I knew. Mm-hmm. And when I stepped into the classroom in Teach for America, at the school that I was in, was actually the worst performing middle school in the community. And the district that I was working in actually had been bankrupt at one point, but there were families and community members who really advocated for it to stay open. You're looking at a school that not only do the families maybe don't have access to resources, but now the schools don't either, right? So I had 180 students, and I would get one box of papers for kids for a full month. And we don't have technologies or one-to-one iPads or any of that, right? So it was so difficult for me to, I think, understand it, because I had never seen outside of my bubble. And it was completely shattered the minute that I walked into the classroom that I did. And I think the biggest epiphany that I got from my time in teaching, whether it was, of course, going into these schools and asking, you know, what are we doing for kids? And, you know, where are the resources and all of that? I will say one thing, it's definitely not the kids. It's the system. You know, these kids are thriving. They want to learn. They're excited. They come from families where their families do want them to be successful, right? That is still the narrative. They want good for their kids. They just unfortunately are in a system where there are a lot of barriers to access for it, for them to thrive. And I didn't realize how many lack of barriers I had in my own life growing up. And then you kind of work with students who have every barrier you could name. So it was definitely a journey, personal and professionally. You know, I grew a lot and exponentially during that time, because I really had to question my life. And it was not an easy process, but definitely a beautiful one, to say the least.
Yeah, that's a big question, questioning where you're going to go in life, right? So, you know, I think the pandemic, we've had this conversation a little bit and in a lot of circles as well. The pandemic kind of opened up the doors to really what's going on in students' lives and in the humanistic approach and the student-led approach. You know, I am guilty of having conversations where, you know, I thought everybody's level was at a certain point. They all had things. And then just like you, out of conversations, I didn't experience it all that much in my career, but there were challenges. They're like, wait, 180 students and one ream of paper. Wait, what? Something's wrong here. And I think a lot of more of that has come up on, you know, systemic problems. You are very creative and very like humanistic, have a very humanistic approach, understanding the students. Tell us a little bit about you as the Como Sha, right? So, which is your website, and we'll put that up. But yeah, tell us a little bit about what you are doing now post-teaching, and how are you helping to change that systemic challenges, I should say, that are happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So before I even get to what I'm doing now, I will say that this all originated when I was in the classroom. So one thing that I was definitely known as was the relationship teacher. So I was the teacher that knew the kids. I had built trust with them. I truly loved them, and they knew that. And so that in itself, I think, is very humanizing, right? Is just being able to see a child for who they truly are versus, you know, what they get on their test. So it was kind of that kind of perception, at least for me as an educator, was always there throughout my time. And then you're adding more to that where I'm questioning everything. And a lot of times with my students who came from trauma or other things in their lives, that was never addressed within those four walls of the classroom, right? It was always just academia. So that kind of questioning and that process has definitely led me to where I am now, because that's kind of where my why came from. And now it's exciting. So I am an educational consultant, and I'm really looking at bringing consciousness to education, which is actually a book I'm right now writing at the same time. And what I mean by that is actually really shifting the narrative of the purpose of education in general. I think we have this idea where our education system is going to kind of build a thriving society. I think that's what most people associate a good education with. Now, the question now becomes, what is a thriving society, right? And I think it's safe to say in the past year, we've seen that what's been going on isn't really working. So I think when we think about this is really shifting the focus to be more humanizing, thus meaning really focusing on a child and their innate qualities and their gifts and their intuition, emotional awareness, and really what makes them human. And it sounds ridiculous, right? We're talking about an education system and schooling system, but yet we have to say that because a lot of times that's not the case. And I didn't see that very often in my own, either my own schooling or honestly when I was an educator. So that's really what my push is now, is how do we actually truly build a thriving society where kids are growing up to lead a positive contribution to the world and are empathetic and are understanding how they heal from their trauma. You know, I think there's so much interconnectedness that honestly gets lost in our schooling because it's so competitive. It's a rat race. It's very individualistic. Of course, we're in a capitalistic society, so it's going to mirror that in some ways. But it's how do we bring it, make it humanizing and build community? Because as we've all seen in the past year, we need that. That's important, you know? And so that's kind of the grand vision of where I'm kind of going with this.
Oh, no. Yeah, it is amazing. As a 20-year veteran of a teaching system, there are numbers, 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 numbers. And then, you know, down the line is the human, right? Which is unbelievable that we haven't changed. There is hope, obviously, in what we're doing. What would be some of the first things in the system? And I know it's a ginormous thing, but the first things you would change?
Wow. Everything? No, I'm kidding. I think the first thing I would change, to be honest, is mindset. That would be my first thing. And the reason why I say that, because I do think education is very personal to people. A lot of times it's built on experience plus cultural factors, plus what success means to you and your family and whoever's in your life. So that's what I mean by personal. Mm-hmm. And the reality is all these people eventually may become educational leaders. And those mindsets is going to be perpetuated in the policies and the systems that they create, right? So the question becomes, how do we also shift the consciousness and the mindsets of all the adults that are in these systems so the systems themselves can shift their mindset? I think we're constantly talking about the schooling system, but we're forgetting that there are people inside of it. And we have to take a step back and really think about self-awareness and mindset. And now someone may say, well, that's not a framework. Like, that's not tangible. But we all know this. We don't change unless it means something to us. We don't. That's the reality. So we have to start asking the questions, even as systemic leaders or system leaders, where we're saying, what do I think the purpose of education is? Is it what the district's telling me, which is the test scores of my students? Is that what's important to my child? Is that what's important to me? I mean, that's scary. No one wants to do that because it's much easier to stay within the system. But we have to break apart our own perceptions in order to break apart the system.
Yeah, totally. You know, I just had a conversation today with one of my colleagues. He's actually a helpful colleague, and I think that's very important as well, is, you know, I think one thing that we fear in education is if we don't put a grade out there, the kids won't do it, right? And yeah. You know, if you unpack that and if you give kids that, what does that transition look like? Because I know in the system, it's very difficult. I've had the mindset conversation with some. And again, these are older students, so they might be burnt out on the system in general. But I'm asking, you know, if I, you know, it's an entrepreneurship class. If I took grades out of this, how many people would really want to learn stuff? And of course, their initial, there's a whole bunch of things on there, but like their initial response was like, I wouldn't do anything. You know, I'd take a nap. Yeah. Now, I know that's not true. There's a learned mindset there, and there's a transition. But where do you think we start with that mindset? Do we start young? Do we start old? Do we, you know, I think both of us are very... we want to change this thing quickly, right? Which I get. Well, I'm not the most patient person. But in your opinion, what does that look like? What does that shift look like?
Yeah, so the first question you asked, which was that transition of grades, the first thing I will say is there are a lot of models out there that are doing it already. Mm-hmm. So there are plenty of places we can go to understand how these schools implemented it. Because guess what? Those students are thriving just as much as anyone else. 100%. So I think it's really important to see that there are models already out there. Also, research. We talk about research so much, but sometimes we use research when it only serves our mindset. And guess what? There's a lot of research out there on intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. I mean, articles and articles about how humans need intrinsic motivation. They are not pushed by extrinsic motivation, and they can be for short-term gratification, but not for long-term gratification of life. And so there's already research being done out on that, and there's research on the detrimental effects of grades.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And how it really affects students and the way they see themselves. And so when people say these kids won't be motivated, my question then becomes, well, of course they won't be, because they've spent many of their schooling years only being motivated by that.
Right.
So they have to be unlearning that to understand. And my other question comes, and this is a little off track, why do we need a grade to motivate them? Then what are we teaching something that's actually relevant? Because if it was relevant, you wouldn't need the grade. We only need the extrinsic motivation because they're not motivated in the first place, because what we're teaching, it doesn't matter to them, right? If you're saying, I'm going to teach you how to balance a bank, you know, a checking account and a savings account, and you're going to balance it for the week, and you're going to talk to your family about finances, and you think they are going to need a grade?
Right.
I mean, my hope is that they're going to be like, this is awesome. Finally, someone's telling me how to do this.
Right.
So that's what I would say on that end. Not like I'm not patient or anything. What are you talking about?
We're two of a kind. I love it.
I know. But to the second part, my hope would be we start young. Mm-hmm. And because I think we have malleable brains, and I think it can change over time. We've all been able to do it. We see it often, but it's harder. Yeah. So I do think we have to start young. And we really have to start implementing in kids that understanding what are innate qualities of children already. Because a lot of what we try to perpetuate onto kids is something that's already within them. A lot of times it's stamped out of them. Kids are already curious. I mean, look at a kid on the beach who's like putting their feet in the water and touching the sand and trying to understand their environment. They're curious. They're learners. They're constantly learning with their environment. They're asking their parents a million and one questions every day. I mean, come on, they want to learn. So they already have that in them. And then they're going into a schooling system and goes, well, yeah, you have all of that, but we're going to teach you what it really means to learn, right? And so that's where that shift happens, I think. So my hope is we start young and we don't implement these detrimental systems and hopefully then don't have to unlearn it later on. Because the reality is we make a lot of apathetic children and some people get used to it and I don't blame them. You know, if you can get by and get A's and work the system and not be invigorated, but you're going to get to college and then you'll figure it out. I mean, the question becomes, do they care? I mean, I get why they wouldn't. Why do I need to be engaged as a learner now when I've been doing just fine so far? But we know that's not always helpful.
that's exactly how I got through school, both and college. You know, that's interesting because, yeah, I played the game, right? You just played the game. And opening up that a little bit more, what I like is looking in the system, and I'm secondary, so even primary, but secondary is so regimented and it's so boom, boom, boom. And we keep saying we're changing away from the industrial age, but we really aren't. Why would we box times and why are we taking away, playground stuff, and when they get older, why not give them those breaks, and those mindfulness moments? What kind of strategies right now are you working with people around? And I know even educators, because we get into the we got to go. 180 kids and one ream of paper is probably going to put a little stress on you as well, obviously. What are some of the topics and the things that you are focusing on, not only in this book, but also in practice?
Yeah, I think some of the topics in the book that I'm talking about is how do we cultivate some of these consciousness components in kids? So simple things as like authenticity or emotional awareness, you know, some of those things that I mentioned ahead of time. Now, if I talk about how to make that tangible, my particular focus would be on adults first, because I do think adults, the reality in the world we live in, have more power than children. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't think that's always the best thing. But if they're the ones who are the primary decision makers in a child's life, then they themselves need to be doing the work. So if I were to come in, it would be more like a workshop where I'm working with educators and different people and having that conversation where they're digging deep into their why. They're becoming self-aware and reflective on their own processes. They're having to sit with themselves and unlearn some of the biases that they've been put on by usually their parents or family members, whoever that may be. It was, you do X, Y, and Z, you will be successful, thus you'll be validated by me, right? And you'll be loved by me. So if, you know, and the reason why I'm saying that, someone else could say, well, that's not really tangible, but I do think it starts there, right? Once you're able to work on yourself, then you feel you're in a community of people that are also doing the work, then you can go and implement that in your classroom. And most of the times it's going to happen naturally because you're doing the work yourself. So to give you a simple example, I said that I was a really good student growing up. And when I was in the classroom, I realized that I liked students that mirrored me as a student. So I liked the kids who were kind of quiet and, you know, sat and kind of high achievers and, you know, so on and so forth. And, you know, I had to have that moment with myself where I went, wait a second, you know, I'm just isolating a bunch of students because they are not validating who I was as a student. So what did I have to do? I had to do the meditation and the self-work and become conscious myself. And by my fifth year of teaching, yes, it was a math classroom, but we talked about feeling and emotions all the time. We meditated together. We talked about breath work. And, you know, a lot of my students were feeling really stimulated when they used to come into the classroom because of so much that was going on outside of it. So it's, how do you take a second and stop and pause? But here's the reality. I would have never implemented it. Someone can tell me this is really good for students. It's really good for students. But unless I'm doing it myself and see the transformation it has within me, I'm not going to be able to do that for my kids. And, you know, I know you've been doing great work too about like wellness and self-care. And I'm not sure if that's a similar story, but when you kind of do it yourself, you go, oh, wow, like this is going to be really important for the kids. I should probably allow that for them as well.
Yeah, 100%. And it is, yeah, it's very interesting because it's such a, it's not new, but it's new in education. We've labeled it with social emotional learning. We've labeled it with all these things. And the funny thing is we have taught it the exact same way we teach math or we teach, and the implementation is all wrong, right? So, and then we're like, okay, let's meditate before we take the SAT, right? It's like, hold on. So there's a lot of different pieces and things to this. Typically, if somebody would come to you, school, parents, educators, students, what would they see and what would they find?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, a lot of the offerings that I do are more workshop based, mm-hmm. and they're more professional development per se. Right. I think a lot of PDs that if a school was to come to me, a lot of PDs, unfortunately, we're not fortunate or unfortunately, I think it's okay, tend to be about the students. Mm-hmm. It's about behavioral management. It's about classroom management. It's about data, data-driven instruction, you know, these buzzwords that we hear all the time in education. But when are we having professional development for educators for themselves? Not very often.
Right.
They're not asked about themselves at all, but the key emphasis of servant leadership is you serve the people who are going to serve your clients. So if that's the same adaptation we want to do in schools, that's where I would come in. It would be a 2-day professional development workshop because we're kind of going intense and we're kind of going intensive in it. It would be engaging because I hate being in workshops that are not engaging, but it would be about them and reflecting, and hopefully they would come out of it with strategies. And there would be also tactical ways in how to implement this in the classroom. So it wouldn't be that those tangible things weren't there, but hopefully by the end too, they would be thinking and having a shift in mindset themselves of how they want to move forward in the classroom as it is. And I think for any school leaders, someone may ask, you know, what's the ROI for us? And I'm going, happier teachers, happier students. I mean, it's really plain and simple. I can give you all the data, but are you going to want to be a principal who has to deal with a teacher who yelled at a student because they were dysregulated and it leads to a parent-teacher conference? Or we just avoid it altogether because both of them are coming from calm places, right? So a lot of what I'm working on with my workshops are more preventative, and they are strategies that can also be implemented but have to be consistent over time. So I would hope that I came back to that school years later and, you know, it's not just a supplemental thing, to your point. I think a lot of times the way we market meditation or mindfulness, it becomes, oh yeah, add that on Fridays, great, you know, or like mindful Mondays, done, we're great, SEL, woohoo. But it's literally integrated into every aspect of the school culture. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that I could come in and make that happen.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I like that because this, honestly, this is the year that I knew I was going to learn the most. And learning's hard, right? And it's difficult because there are failures in it. But this is the year I really took to heart meditation every morning, like in consistency and keeping digital stuff away from me for an hour and a half or so after I got up and those types of things. My dogs help too, but you know, so let me ask you this in teacher training, and you mentioned it a little bit, like classroom management. Now I haven't been in teacher training for a while, but I have seen a lot of curriculum around it. It's still majority of get your curriculum in there and understand how to manage a class. What would be some things that you would change to that? Because I don't think there's a lot of things outside of that right now that are coming into teacher schools.
Yeah. First of all, I would say I empathize, right? I think it's really hard for teachers. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we put so much pressure on these test scores and getting their kids to learn lessons that, let's be honest, after the test, they're going to forget anyways. And it is really unfortunate. So if I were to talk within the confines of a classroom, a couple of things that I would tell a teacher is ask yourself, how often are you in the front? How often are you talking? in the classroom, and how often are your kids engaged? And engagement, when I say, does not mean sitting silently and listening to you. What I mean by engaged is they're engaged in their learning and they're talking to each other about the subject matter. So one thing that was a shift for me is between my first year of teaching and my fifth year of the teaching, I used to sit in the back. And I was in a school that was pretty traditional as well in terms of how it was being taught. It was collaborative. They did emphasize that. So a lot of what I did is I had to put my ego aside, realize that it wasn't about me. It was about my students learning. And I put in the work from the beginning. So I spent about the first couple of months really training my students in terms of leadership, around student voice, around what it feels to be in front of the classroom, training them, giving them the culture that this is about you, not me. And I had to do really intentional things. If a student asked me for something, I would say, did you ask your peers? Yeah, I did. Okay. Hey, Jose, what did I ask you? No, I didn't ask him. Exactly. Go back and ask him. Right? So I had to be very intentional about even what my role in the classroom was. But not only that, I had to model that for months.
Yeah.
And I had to really take myself out of the picture. Now, they knew that I like loved them and that I would be there for them. So it wasn't coming from like, let me ignore you. But it was more you have to lean on each other. And I will say that by the end of it, we're still learning the lessons, but they're interactive, they're group works, hopefully project-based, but as we know, timing can be an issue in a traditional space. But within the confines of your classroom, there is actually a lot that can be done. And I think a lot of educators have fear around it. And I understand where the fear comes from, because you're saying, if I lose control, my classroom will be out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is when you lose control, your kids become in control, and thus they will actually be more in control of themselves and their learning. And when you shift that mindset, I've seen it over and over again when I taught, of just how different my classroom was. And my kids would tell me, they're like, it's different in here. You know, we get to do fun stuff and I'm engaged and it's exciting and it's loud. You know, board members would come into my room and the CEO would say, well, we come in your room because they're talking to each other. You're usually walking around. You're the facilitator. You're not really doing anything besides answering their questions, but they're kind of running the show. And I'm like, oh my gosh, is there another way? Like, I don't want anything else to do with this. But what I will say is it's possible.
Yeah.
It is possible.
100%. I mean, yeah, that fear is real. I have been in five or six different schools, and certain schools, it is like that. And it's unfortunate. And I hope our leaders, like if you could say one thing to the leaders, you mentioned principals a little bit, you know, but what would be one thing that school leaders need to know a little bit beyond what you mentioned before?
That's a great question. I think the first thing I would tell them is, are you trying to cultivate children to be obedient or to be thriving in our world?
Hmm.
And that's not a fun thing to say, but that's what we do a lot.
Yeah. That's a mic drop.
Like... Oh, yeah. Is that it? Okay.
Yeah, no. Go ahead. Sorry. That was great, though. It was.
Yeah. I think we have to humanize it.
Yeah.
They're more than a test score. They are. And I know that you're being evaluated based off of that. And I know it's hard. But we have to have more people who are willing to take the charge and say, it's not about me. It's about the 700 kids at my school who will one day be adults, who I'll be relying on one day to sustain this economy and do some good contribution for this world. So you know what? I'm going to make sure that they make that happen now, right? I mean, this is not a small feat. This is a big feat. But there's so many effects when you don't do it.
Right.
And I can talk about the mental health crisis for a very long time. And it's a lot of what I talk about in my book. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's an adolescence, but it's adults. And I always say adults are children in an adult's body. So we have to ask ourselves, what led them to this? Why are they breaking down?
Right.
And that would be a big conversation with system leaders of how do we create a world that doesn't normalize it? Because what's happening in our world, that's not normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not.
That's another mic drop in there. I love it. But it is so true, the big picture and seeing down the road, and this is our next generation. I want to give you a chance to give a shout out of how can people connect with you. You do awesome things. Leaders need to hear this. Leaders need to take the risks. Teachers need this. And then eventually, you know, it does get to our students, right? So how can people connect with you?
Yeah, no, thank you. So I'm very active on LinkedIn. So I would actually say the first thing anyone can do is please go ahead and just connect with me on LinkedIn. Happy to also just have a coffee chat, just set up some time to just speak with you, kind of how things are going, what your role is in education. So that would be a start. There's also a website, which you said you were going to link as well. So you can also go on there if you want to see more of my services and what my offerings are, if that's something you're interested in. And as I mentioned, my book is coming out soon. So I would love everyone's support. I do talk about it a lot on LinkedIn, but pre-sales open on April 2nd. So that is a time where I'm raising funds to publish my book, and it will be out in August. So awesome. The more hands I can get on it, the better, because, you know, I do think this is not about me. This is about the next generation, like you said, and I'm hoping that it will catalyze a good conversation.
Fantastic. So I'm going to end on, you have a 16-year-old in a system, they're struggling. What's one word of advice do you have for that person or the parent of that child?
You are valued, you are loved, you have a purpose in this world, and you will find it. Don't let the system tell you otherwise.
See, you're such a mic dropper. It's so great. I love it. Kamal, thank you so much for hanging out with us on Disrupt Education. We really appreciate you and what you do.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Peter. It was so much fun.
Great, great. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Disrupt Education.